a foundation for the deaf. The friend I loved was deaf. Malcolm overheard Raoul's voice and realized he'd been put on speakerphone.
Sorry, old man. And thanks so much. Gotta run. Let me know if you have any other tips.
Everyone was pleased to hear that Raoul had scored a victory.
So you go back?
Asked Margot.
So I go back, he replied.
And can you take people with you?
You mean like a travel guide for time travel tourists?
If you put it that way.
I have.
Whom would you take if you had a choice?
Raoul looked around the group of eight.
I'd select Oscar.
Why me?
You'll see.
Oscar needs to recall that he once lived in Antwerp and was named Christoffel Leuven, started Raoul. Christoffel had a very sick mother, who despite her illness lived a very long life, and as a result of needing constant tending night and day, made it impossible for him to find a wife. Or so he wanted it rumored. He could free himself for only 2 to 3 hours every day to pen letters for people who did not know how to write, or who loved his handwriting and preferred to dictate them to him. But the rest of the time he read and wrote letters. Letters to countless individuals in Europe, Russia, North and South America, always in flawless French, which he had learned at school and mastered perfectly. He had a witty pen, and everyone he wrote to always responded. Writers, composers, philosophers, leaders, including Count Cavour, Louis-Philippe, Empress Eugenie, Ivan Turgenev, Franz Liszt. When years later his mother died, he was already an old man whose sole passion by then was writing letters and amassing a huge stamp collection with their original letters and envelopes. The collection is priceless. A distant nephew got wind of the collection, and on inheriting all of Christoffel's property, would have sold it to a reputable dealer, except that he died a few days before concluding the sale. No one knows of its existence.
Where is it?
It was left in an attic, said Raoul.
Is the building still there?
You mean, hasn't it burned down yet, or been bombed during the war?
No, it hasn't.
Do you know the address by any chance? Asked Oscar.
Raoul laughed.
Yes, I do. I will give it to you.
All you have to do when you show up at the door is say you are the grandson of Christoffel Leuven's nephew and have come to collect a package that was left for you. The old lady who owns the house and who knew the nephew won't be any trouble. You are, in my view, the rightful owner. With your gift of the gab, I'm sure you'll charm her.
Oscar was nonplussed and didn't know whether to truly believe any of it.
The important thing, as I said, is making contact. There are, as so many physicists will tell you, occasional openings between one time warp and another that are no wider than a sheet of onion paper. Then the slit shuts, and you need to wait generations, centuries, who knows, millennia, for the next opportunity.
Will the visit be worth the trip?
Oh, yes. Said Raoul. It will change your life and allow you to leave your job, pay off your college loans, and sail off with the young sailor who lent you his hat 2 nights ago.
You're terrifying, said Oscar, bursting out laughing.
I know,
smiled the gentleman from Peru, feeling quite pleased with himself. I know you get this all the time, but would you do me a favor? Asked Angelica.
What?
Tell us, about me and Paul.
Are you under the impression that yours is just love?
Seriously, I've watched how you look at each other when the other isn't watching. And it's almost as if your life is in his life and his in yours. You've been friends since college, and you've gone out with God knows how many others. You even got married to a very wealthy man whom you care for, but have never and will never love. The decision on what to do is yours entirely. But if I know one thing from my own life, don't wait and don't give up. Not now. Behind your love today, there are entire lives of missed encounters and chance meetings. Once you lived in Baltimore, and he in Mexico, and you met on a ship headed to, of all places, Anchorage. You both knew knew right away. But one was in first class, the other in second, and you got off and he stayed on, and you never met again. Years and another lifetime later, he was a clerk in a haberdashery, and you walked in with your son, trying to buy a present for your husband, and once again, the two of you knew. And neither dared. Does either of you remember the shop? Angelica and Paul stared at each other. No, we don't, one of them said. Of course you don't. And yet? The shop was in Helsinki, almost abutting a wharf. Think of it together. I'll say no more. Raoul went on to tell them about the Lugentis Campi, where all unfulfilled loves are parked, waiting, waiting, waiting. Most of us live our lives waiting for the right alignment, for this is what life is, a waiting room. But feel for the dead, who take what they've waited for to the underworld and continue waiting to come back to Earth to be made to live again and wait some more. So, better 1 hour spent doing things we'll regret having done than a lifetime waiting for heaven to touch our lives. The wannabe lovers looked at each other like teenagers fumbling with the facts of life, almost asking what they should do next. They remembered meeting the first time during registration in New England, but Helsinki, really? They remembered losing each other in school. I drifted away hoping you'd come looking for me, but you never did. You drifted because you didn't want me to look for you. And you met others. You knew they were a sham. Not after a while. Why didn't you at least try? I did try. Not that I saw. Did you think of her? Asked Raoul. All the time. And did you know? He asked Angelica. I did know, but I stopped believing. He made such a secret of it. But there wasn't and still isn't a single day when I don't catch myself hoping he thinks of me. Margot, who had been listening with Oscar, couldn't help but throw in, Helsinki? What were you doing in Helsinki in your previous life? You're asking me? Ask him. The third round of drinks finally arrived and found everyone sitting down eager to ask Raoul about their own lives. Doesn't the passage of time make you sad, though? Asked Claire of Angelica. Living for the past 10 years with someone who could be the wrong man? Doesn't that bother you? Yes. It makes me very sad. But what makes me sadder yet is that I may do nothing, despite Paul's admission or mine. We may decide to lead the wrong life because we've gotten used to it. No, said Claire. Tonight feels almost like a Midsummer's Night dream. Spaces open up, errors are repaired, destiny's untangled, and everything can be redressed. Is that what this place is for you? Asked Raoul. Well, look at this bar. With the boat stopped, all of us have stepped out of time. Our troubles are left behind, and our revels hardly started. Something good is bound to occur. And with this, ladies and gentlemen, I bid you good night. Otherwise, tomorrow at sunup, we'll all be quite a sight. Chapter 3. For the next 2 days, Raoul had totally disappeared. And then suddenly there he was, as though he'd been there all along. And the three who were coming barefoot up the uneven ancient treads leading from the beach to the hotel had simply failed to notice him. Angelica, Margot, and Emma. That morning he was wearing a large straw hat, a pair of soiled shorts, a t-shirt that had seen better days, and was on his knees with a trowel in hand, helping the gardener weed the edge of the stone-paved walk leading to the patio. When he saw them, he stood up, tried to clear his hand of earth against his shorts, but sensing he was unable to rid it of dirt, withdrew it with a self-conscious smile. You disappeared, said Margot. I had to go across to the island to sign some deeds, and ended up spending the night there. He had a sunny disposition that morning, and while staring at them, smiled many more times than he'd done over lunch the first time they'd met. But here, I was trying to finish this little stretch before lunch, he said, surveying the work he'd done, and clearly not displeased with what he'd accomplished that day. I find this the best therapy in the world. You almost catch yourself talking to the ground, to these stones to some of these weeds that I must uproot, and to the worms themselves, whom you don't want to disturb. And frankly, the silence is so intense and so magnificent. It's the pleasure people take in fishing, if you like fishing, which I hate. I love the heat when it's not so humid. And where are you people coming from?
We've just been swimming. Funny you should ask, though, said Marco.
Why?
I thought you knew everything. Or have you forgotten? She said.
The dart hit its mark.
The weather was so wonderful, we lay on the beach, then swam forever up to the stationary barge, said Angelica, clearly trying to ease out Margot's little dart.
Raoul adjusted his hat, almost looking for something to say, and finding nothing, looked at Marco. I think I've upset you, Marco.
You mean Maria, she said, with a sly look on her face, as though struggling to contain a smile.
Now you're being cruel to me. I was just trying to apologize for the other day.
Accepted, she replied.
Her answer had come so swiftly that Raoul was uncertain whether hers was a perfunctory nod at his apology or an attempt to fend off formalities. Not knowing how to read her curt reply, he asked the three of them if they would accept to join him for lunch at 2.
Emma said she was going back swimming, while Angelica said she was just about to have a very light snack with Paul.
Why at 2? Asked Marco.
The dining area clears out a bit and it gets quieter.
You mean after the young Americans leave the dining area and everyone else goes to nap?
Something like that.
She pondered the invitation a tad longer than is usual. Accepted.
Will you allow me to order for the two of us now? I usually order what they catch earlier that day.
She looked at him and smiled. I said, accepted.
Peace, then?
We'll see about that.
Please say yes.
Her smile was meant to convey a tepid, all right, but he decided to take it as a categorical yes.
Now, I must get back to my weeding, otherwise the gardener will fire me.
At 2 on the dot, she arrived wearing a white linen blouse, baggy white linen trousers, and a sky blue linen scarf. Her red sandals displayed slim feet that seemed less tanned than he'd noticed earlier that day when she stood barefoot, holding her flip-flops on the stone walk to the hotel.
Am I late? She asked, sensing he must have been seated for quite a while.
He looked at her, smiled, and simply shook his head to mean,
What could have made you think you were late?
I always worry.
Why? Are you always late?
No, never. But I do worry all the same. My ex used to be the opposite.
How do you mean?
He used to come ahead of time, which always gave me the impression that I'd kept him waiting.
Then on thinking more,
but why am I telling you this?
I don't know. Why?
Then suddenly, with that same sly, quizzical look on her face she'd worn a few hours earlier, she couldn't resist asking, but you must have known this about me. Don't you know everything?
Oh, I see,
he said, as they brought the slices of raw fish he'd ordered a couple of hours earlier. The waiter, meanwhile, explained what sort of fish it was, when it was caught, and which olive oil the chef had used. The oil was a touch peppery, but nothing to intimidate anyone.
Would you allow me to apologize once again? He said, ignoring the waiter, who was about to explain the garnish on the vegetable medley, but decided to leave them alone.
You don't have to.
But I want to.
Why?
I don't know why. At this, they both laughed. Contrary to what you think, I don't know everything. Sometimes things just come to me, and I'm not always able to hold my tongue. But please, tell me why I upset you so much.
I'm not sure I know either.
Was it the truth about your name or your birthday that you didn't want to hear? Or was it just my excavating private facts about Basil's twin that bothered you?
Maybe both. The fact is, it scared me how you could be so totally right about things that no one knew a thing about, and that those who did had totally forgotten. It frightened me, especially about the cannibalized twin. Or maybe I didn't want to hear that at all.
So sorry.
He reached out and placed his right palm over her left hand. She did not remove it, but he removed his.
This will be fantastic fish, I promise, he said, changing the conversation.
Do you know everything about fish as well? She asked as she cut a slice.
This, he figured, was a tacit little jab, but he liked it.
Absolutely not. In fact, I know nothing about cooking.
You never cook for yourself?
Almost never.
After the raw fish appetizer came another fish, this time broiled. They had a salad, then dessert, all accompanied by one of the best white wines of the region. At the end of their meal, they were served a grappa. It was nearing 4 when they decided to order a second round of grappas. After the tall septuagenarian waiter had finished pouring it, Raoul finally told her how happy he was that she had accepted his invitation to lunch.
Moments like these happen so rarely in life. I just hope I'm not keeping you from your friends.
You're not keeping me from my friends, she said, echoing his very words to suggest an implicit touch of humor. But then you knew I was free this afternoon, didn't you?
I know facts, or the general contour of facts, not feelings or what goes on in someone's mind, which is why I've not always been lucky in my life when it came to people. I'm not sure I ever learned how to read people.
You don't look like the sort who misreads people or who's been unlucky in life. He gave a heedless half-shrug, half-nod.
I've been lucky in my life, true, but then again, lucky in facts, lucky with things, but not in what mattered most to me.
She stopped drinking from her tiny grappa glass and held it in midair. Meaning love?
Exactly.
Has anyone really been lucky when it comes to love?
A few have.
Not many. But I know some who have, he said with doubt still lining his features, which meant he wasn't entirely convinced, which is why the two ended up laughing. Aren't you married? She asked.
I've been married. Once when I was in my 30s, and once 11 years ago. And there have been people in between. But now that I look back, I realize I've never loved any of the women I've lived with.
Not one?
Well, one, yes.
Was this recently?
No, when I was in my early 20s. The ones before her, I don't remember at all, and those who came after were just stopgaps, placeholders, fillers. When I look back...
But he didn't finish his sentence. The silence that hung between them on that very mild afternoon was not unpleasant. She threw her head back to enjoy the weather and the late afternoon light better. Or perhaps it was simply her body showing how pleased she was to be spending a very quiet afternoon this way. When he looked down, he saw that she had removed her red sandals and was allowing her feet to rest on the warm gravel underfoot. He could hear her raking the pebbles with her toes, softly, slowly. When they'd finished drinking, he asked if she would take a walk with him, not too far from the hotel grounds. She didn't say no. He put his straw hat on, and before stepping onto the dirt-paved road outside the hotel lobby, stood still for a moment.
I love the sound, he said.
What sound?
The total silence. Turtle doves, far, far away. The clamor of one or two kids playing in the bay. The occasional lawnmower droning quietly on a pleasant summer afternoon while everyone is still napping. I never nap.
I never nap either.
Yes, I know.
She nodded.
Have I been forgiven? He asked.
She smiled at him. The jury's still out. Then thinking he might misread her,
clearly I have. See what a simple but wonderful lunch can accomplish.
Without replying, she slipped into her sandals and stood next to him.
Come, we'll take a short walk.
She thought he was going to take her along the shore. Instead, he led her outside the hotel grounds, then up a hill that was covered with marine pines. It led to a narrow, unpaved road that finally worked its way through what looked like a wood. The wood was unusually silent and gave off an air of intense peace and tranquility she had seldom encountered before. She stopped and breathed in the scent of pines. Heavenly, she said.
Isn't it?
He added, and he too stopped to breathe in the light afternoon air.
A few more yards and we're there, he said.
When they reached the end of the wood, they arrived at a flat plot of land.
The field of melons, he said.
The smell there was overpowering and enticingly sweet and stirred a bewildering sense of hunger, which the act of eating could never soothe, the way he said certain scented soaps stimulate a desire to bite into them, which everyone knows not to do. Finally, they arrived at a garden that boasted exotic plants that had never been planted elsewhere in Europe. The son of the original owner of more than a century ago, he explained, had sailed to the Far East and brought back seeds which he secretly planted against his father's wishes. This is why the garden was hidden in the woods. He spent years planting these fruit trees in secret until his father's death. But by then, the garden had blossomed and could no longer be moved, so it stayed hidden here. Many of the plants perished, of course, but some survived and thrived. Was she interested in plants and gardens? He asked. Not at all, she replied. Or didn't you know? I suspected, he replied, smiling to signal he was aware of her insinuation. Still, I wanted to show you something. After pushing a gate that grated loudly against the ground before letting them inside, he turned around to let her take in a view of the other bay that she had never known existed. Under the spellbinding afternoon sun, it felt as though they were standing a mile above the sea. Is this what you wanted to show me? No, he replied. This here is the spice garden, of no interest to people who are not interested in gardening, he added after bending down and rubbing his hand on a plant that stood knee-high. He then brought his palm to her nose. Smell this. What is it? She said, brusquely withdrawing her face from the reach of his palm. Smell it first. Yes, but what is it? She kept asking before consenting to smell it. You don't trust me, do you? Here, rub your hands on these leaves and smell. She finally relented, and she seemed surprised. I know the smell. Reminds me of something, but I can't tell what. It's lovely, isn't it? Then giving her time to reflect, he added, almost like lemongrass, but not lemongrass, and like lavender, but not lavender. And yet I'll bet you've never smelled it before, though it stirs something like memory, but then not memory. Shakes up your limbic system, though, doesn't it? But I know it. She leaned down and tore a stem off the plant to take with her. I love this scent, she said. As they continued to walk through the sodden ground, they eventually came upon a small hut where a gardener sat on a stool repairing a rake. Commendatore, he said, rising on his feet. Raoul greeted him and told him that he wanted to borrow the long pole to shake some fruit from the tree for the signorina. Does everyone know you here? She asked. I spent all my summers here. None of those who grew up in this area have moved, and all have kept the same jobs. Time stops here. In fact, when I come here, I do nothing. I like doing nothing. You saw me working the hotel grounds. That's the most I do. The gardener went into the shed and came out with an old pole. He offered it to Raoul, but then said he would be perfectly willing to knock some of the fruit for him. But Raoul said he'd do it himself. He'd been doing it since childhood. I wanted you to tell me what you thought. It's not a passion fruit, but it has a nuance of passion fruit and of pomegranate, maybe guava. But no one knew what to call it, so they called it frutta dell'ira, fruit of wrath, though no one knows why, possibly because the owner of the land hated that his son was planting so many exotic plants and trees here and kept scolding him. Or maybe because the fruit has growths like goosebumps and overgrown pimples and turns so red at this time of the year. As they approached the tree, she thought she saw something move. There are all manner of birds here, but they're very timid and quiet. Follow me. When they finally reached a tall lean tree, he pointed to what looked like full-blooded ruby spiky pears at the topmost reaches of the tree. Hence the pole, he said. I used to rob this tree of so much fruit once. And having said that, he started poking one of the fruits until it was finally freed from its twig and came tumbling down through stems and branches. He managed to catch it with both his hands. He inserted both thumbs into it, opened it, and released a huge number of very tiny black seeds that looked like caviar or guava seeds. Sometimes they have tiny worms inside, but this one is totally clean. Want to try a taste? Frutta dell'ira? she questioned its name. Frutta dell'ira. My mother used to peel off the skin, remove all the seeds, then slice up the fruit and let the whole thing sit in lemon juice. It was naturally quite sweet, which is why she added salt. I have the most amazing memories of this fruit salad. But ever since she died, no one makes this dessert any longer.
Did you grow up here?
Only during summers. Our house is on the other side of the hill. I'll take you there sometime.
When?
The suddenness of her question surprised him. He looked at her and smiled. Tomorrow, if you like.
Are we having lunch too?
If you wish, of course.
Will you order the exact same thing?
Yes, easily. But don't you find me boring?
No.
Maybe slightly.
Well, yes, especially when you ask like this. She tasted the fruit, pondered, finished her half of it, while he bit into his half all the while watching her. Pomegranate, but not pomegranate. Maybe guava, but not guava. He looked at her, baffled. It took him a moment to realize she was teasing by echoing words he'd spoken moments earlier.
Ever had this before? Bring back any memories?
Very, very vaguely. But I don't know of what, but it is sweet. He did not wait to be asked, and using the rod released another fruit. But he did not let go of the rod in time so that the fruit came crashing down and splattering its contents on the ground.
Pity.
He tried for another. This time, she caught it. She did what he had done and pressed it open, and breaking a twig from one of the trees, used it to scrape off the seeds. She liked the fruit. The fruit salad shouldn't be too difficult to make. I wonder why they call it frutta dell'ira.
And I thought you weren't interested in plants or gardens.
She told him she was a good cook.
Yes, I know, he said, then caught himself. Let's go back, he said.
So lunch tomorrow then? She asked.
Same time,
same spot, he replied. They returned the way they had come and parted at the entrance to the hotel, where her friends were waiting for a swim.
Tomorrow, come with a bathing suit. I'll show you the Baia di Montesacro, a place no one knows exists.
She waved goodbye and had already taken off her sandals. And thank you for lunch. He shrugged his shoulders to mean,
no need for thanks, no fussy formalities, no pressure. It was, after all, entirely his pleasure.
Chapter 4.
When he arrived, she was already seated at his table. He removed his sunglasses and was happy to notice that she had taken his seat, most likely to allow him to have the shade this time. She was wearing a straw hat, the top of her bathing suit and a skirt underneath.
I did what you said.
He was wearing shorts and a pair of sandals.
Still a lovely surprise, he said.
I thought this was the plan.
Yes, I know, but I'm still very happy we're having lunch again.
By then, almost all the tables had been set for dinner and the patrons had left. I want to order the exact same things we ordered yesterday. They ordered the same white wine, the same raw fish salad. And as for the fish, it was indeed the same as the previous days, except it was that day's catch.
But we'll try a different dessert.
No frutta dell'ira ice cream?
If only.
He liked that she remembered, liked that she didn't hide recalling its name.
Enjoy the wine, because on a day like today, it is the most amazing thing on planet Earth.
I agree.
After we're done, I'll show you a couple of spots tourists never see.
The appetizers came. She ate her roll, then borrowed some of his, then simply took all of it. He enjoyed watching her eat. She noticed he was looking at her. Finally, she said, "You're staring."
"Yes, I am."
She gave a faint, quiet smile, then continued cutting her fish. "Why?"
"Because I like that we are friends."
She gave a pensive nod. Me too.
Most people won't say this,
but I do. When they were done and stood up, he watched her slip her feet easily back into the red sandals he had admired less than 24 hours earlier. They walked along the Strada Bianca. Except for the few salespeople headed hastily to their gift shops, The road was totally empty under the intense afternoon sun. Margot had to stop a moment, complaining that a pebble had gotten into her sandal and was bothering her. He held her hand as she removed her sandal, couldn't find the pebble, shook the sandal some more, then leaning on his shoulder, put the sandal back on. He noticed that her sandal had left a slim X-shaped pattern of lighter skin on her otherwise tanned foot. "Is it far?" she asked.
"Not at all."
Within 10 minutes, they'd reached the end of a road that led to the highway.
"Almost there," he said. And sure enough, they stepped over an old, collapsed, weather-beaten wood fence that opened the way to the shore and then proceeded down the very slim arm of land that cut deep through the bay and then curved inward, almost creating a semicircle, which explained why not even a ripple reached the shore here. There was no sign of civilization, as though neither the Greeks nor the Romans nor the original inhabitants of the area had ever touched this spot of land where even the aged olive trees, which grow in phalanx formation elsewhere on the Italian peninsula, were scattered wildly about and seemed untended by human hands. As always, the tireless chorus of the cicadas and the moan of turtle doves. It was the most peaceful spot on earth, and the sea, under the languorous late mid-afternoon light, was as calm and limpid as a pair of beautiful slow eyes that never shed tears.
"Does anyone swim here?"
"People did once, but everyone prefers the crowded resort beaches. Want to try?"
She nodded.
"I still come here in the morning. No one, not a single soul ever comes. And when you want shade, the ancient olive groves are happy to oblige. There are fig trees behind, and the figs are free for the taking come August through September."
She wanted to walk along the shore and dip her toes in the water.
"This is my spot," he said,
and began removing his clothes down to his swimming suit. She hesitated for an instant, but he had turned his back and let her undress. She had even removed her watch and her necklace and simply dumped them on her clothes. She still looked around nervously, as though still uncertain there really was no one, then raced toward the water. By that hour of the day, the sunlight has grown diffuse and the glare more muted, and once the two crawled out till their feet could no longer touch bottom, they tread water, feeling a sense of plenitude and pure bliss wash over them.
"Look behind you," he said, pointing to the shore.
When she turned to look, the bay suddenly appeared so very distant and more deserted and more paradisiacal than she could have imagined.
"There's not a thing to want here," he said.
"You're so right.
This, according to legend, is possibly where the Lotus Eaters lived."
"You mean Ulysses' companions, who refused to sail back to Ithaca?" "I can see why now," she said, once again making light of her college education.
"I love walking all the way here, love reading here under the shade of one of those trees, and then love the walk back, with sand still in my sandals, which takes me back to my childhood, when I used to hate having sand trapped in my sandals and preferred walking barefoot. Coming here reminds me that I do love planet Earth, that I like being alive, that I might even like myself."
"Don't you always feel like this?"
"No," he replied, almost too rapidly. "I already told you, no one I know does. Some pretend to, others try hard to fool themselves, but no one likes who they truly are, except in spurts. When I feel the sun on my skin, and the water nearby, and happen to like where I am, I try my best to coddle the feeling. The only other thing that comes close for me is chamber music and tennis."
"And nothing else?"
"Sometimes that, too, but not always."
They decided to crawl farther out.
"You swim well," he said.
"Parents came with tennis and piano lessons. You're a good swimmer yourself."
"This was my beach once upon a time. I used to come here with my mother. Then I got in the habit of coming alone, and then with someone special."
"The one and only?"
"The one and only."
What would you pay me not to tell my friends about the stretch of beach?
You won't tell them.
How do you know? She asked, dunking under water, then coming back up and throwing her hair back while passing both palms along her face and nose.
Because this is our spot, yours now and mine, and no one else's, he replied,
then looked away at the distant eastern arm of the bay.
Proprietary, aren't we? She said.
Maybe. Yes.
He asked if she could spot the very tip of the land extension before them. She said she could. He told her that there used to be a structure there once, and asked if she had any idea what it might have been. They'd taken it down decades before. She thought for a moment, then said,
I suppose a lighthouse, most likely abandoned at least a century and a half ago, she said.
Why abandoned?
Just a hunch. What would a lighthouse be doing here anyway?
He agreed with her. They both said it would have been a small lighthouse.
Striped black and white, you think?
He hazarded. She thought a while.
No, I suspect it must have been more like a squat little hut made of stacked boulders with a strange round attic-looking structure from which scant light emanated to warn mariners of rocks and shoals. But I doubt it even gyrated as lighthouses do elsewhere.
When I was a boy, he said, there used to be such a structure there, but totally abandoned in those days. My mother once told me that it was used by the Germans during the war. I was never allowed to go near there, for fear of unexploded mines underfoot. But eventually, once you swam to the rock where we're headed, you could actually walk along the very shallow edge of land and reach the lighthouse.
They continued to swim till they reached the large rock.
As an adolescent, I used to come here to be alone, like being on another planet and stepping totally out of time. A wonderful feeling of pure quiet and pure being one with Earth.
I've never felt such wonderful water before, she said. I even like its taste.
Welcome to the Tyrrhenian Sea.
He climbed on the rock and sat on what was clearly his usual spot. Then he reached with both his hands for hers and helped her climb up.
Do you always bring women up here?
Never.
Except for the one and only?
The one and only, yes. But that's 40 years and 2 months ago.
And how many days?
I can tell you if you need to know.
She did not answer.
We used to bring fruits and sit as we're doing now.
Dark grapes, I'm betting?
Yes. Something about seawater and fruit. Then I realized what it was. Salt makes fruit sweeter.
Next time we'll remember to bring fruit. How about the frutta de lira?
That was her favorite. We spent hours sitting on this rock, just as we're doing now. And we spoke so much, and laughed even more than we spoke.
He stopped for a second.
I'm happy you're here, though.
Though? She immediately asked.
I meant, I'm happy it's you here.
She didn't know exactly what to add, or whether she'd understood his answer, so she did not reply.
I find myself strangely envious of her, of the two of you, and I don't even know why.
We were so young at the time, so young. Nothing held us back.
But he found himself deflecting the subject, as though something hovered between them, and neither wished to bring it up.
From here we can swim to the very tip of the eastern arm of the bay.
She nodded.
Afterward, we'll either walk to where we left our clothes or swim back. Then we'll dry on the sand. With this heat, one dries in no time.
They visited the spot where the lighthouse once stood and where the Germans had stationed a makeshift post. Then they swam back to shore. They waited a short while, then walked to the fallen fence and there, having relatively dried themselves, put on their clothes. He gave her his cotton sweater. She wrapped the sleeves around her shoulders.
This was just lovely, she said. I wonder what people will think seeing me arrive wearing your sweater.
They can think whatever they please.
Without putting their sandals on, but letting their feet drag into the sand to dry faster, they reached the end of the eastern arm of Earth that suddenly looked more like a jetty, extending far off into the water and into sunlight. As they continued walking, he bent down and picked up a pumice stone
then offered it to her. I haven't seen a real wild pumice stone in my life. Thank you. Those they sell nowadays in the States have such tiny holes, they look and feel like pieces of cement cut small to fit your palm. She toyed with the stone and seemed fascinated by its lightness. Should we head back? She asked.
Soon. I'll take you by way of a shortcut. It's on the other side of the hill. Much prettier.
The shortcut Raoul had in mind lay hidden off the coast and crossed the main street of the adjacent town. And indeed, as they approached, Margot saw that the principal street was milling with tourists and vacationers stopping at one high-end store after the other, with the occasional gelato vendor, enoteca, and espresso bar.
Unbelievable, but this used to be a dirt-poor fishing hamlet once. Now it's a boutiqueified Potemkin village. Its stores used to sell fruits, vegetables, and always fish.
Raoul stepped inside one of the bars and purchased two small bottles of sparkling water and handed Margot a bottle. How did you know I was dying for water?
Why didn't you say anything?
Actually, I didn't think of it. They stopped for a short while as they drank from their respective bottles. This was exactly like every tourist town on both Italian coastlines. One boutique after the other, with a de rigueur porcelain shop bearing regional patterns and motifs that are manufactured and painted elsewhere. Were none of these stores here?
Not one.
What was this, a bus depot?
And what else?
She looked around her and couldn't begin to know what this town had once been.
Just take a guess, he prodded.
A garage, a movie theater. And then she corrected herself. A slaughterhouse.
What made you guess a slaughterhouse? He asked.
No idea. She looked around and saw a plaque stating Piazza del Macello. Maybe because I read the plaque without realizing it.
Do you even know what macello means in Italian?
No.
Then how could it have helped you guess what used to be here?
I don't know. Why are you cross-examining me? Raoul right away recognized the signs.
Am I upsetting you?
A little, yes.
Why?
I don't know why, but you are. He explained that he simply wanted to show her how this rinky-dink little place from nothing became a hotbed of high-end shops.
Take a look at this triple cinema here, playing the same superhero film in all three theaters. In my day, there was no cinema here.
What was there?
Any child could tell you that.
What, a bus depot for some of those tiny buses running up and down the coast?
And near the depot?
How would I know? A winery? You're quizzing me again.
No, I'm not.
Yes, you are.
Okay, so I was a bit. This whole new building, which is made to look Gothic, was something else in my day. It was a huge, helter-skelter improvised amusement park that lasted only a few weeks. My parents used to take me there. Then the poles and tents and swing carousels and bump cars would suddenly disappear until the following year.
So saying, they walked up a narrow road, neatly paved with cobblestones that were embedded into the ground in arched patterns. When they reached the top of the hill, they found a lovely tea hut with crowded tables and chairs, where those who had come for shopping were taking a rest. Beyond the tea house, they spotted a large rectangular 19th-century villa surrounded by rich vegetation and a flower garden, next to which stood a similar house, but much smaller, built to seem its younger sister. Both houses had mansard roofs and looked nothing like any building seen in southern Italy.
Feels like Normandy, she finally said.
Not surprising. The man who had it built was a Frenchman who wanted a French home overlooking the Tyrrhenian Sea. By the way, it leads directly down the hill to the beach where we swam. Come, I'll take you there.
You've been there before?
More times than I remember. This used to be our summer home. The smaller house was a guest house and a haven when we were kids, since this was where all my parents' friends' children stayed.
They walked up the hill and rang the bell. There was the sound of children playing. Eventually, they heard steps, and the lady of the house opened the door. She immediately exclaimed Raoul's name and hugged him very affectionately. They bandied their usual jokes.
You never come. You know I can't stand you, but we love you. Plus your food is horrible.
Turning to Margot, he informed her that Doriana was a cordon bleu chef. Introductions were made. Doriana insisted on serving tea. Margot said it wasn't necessary. Doriana persisted. Margot relented.
You're worse than he is, Doriana said, turning to Margot. And I thought no one could be worse. I wanted to show her the house. We'll stay for your horrible tea and cookies.
And with that, Doriana hopped into the kitchen, screaming at the children who massed around her when they heard the English word cookie.
Next fall, they're all going back to boarding school, and I'll be done with a lot of them, and finally have time to finish my book on the terrible end of Masaniello.
Then turning to Margot, I'm just a historian.
Come, I'll show you around, said Raoul.
He walked her through the hallway, then into the dining room, which led to a large terrace, from which, once he opened the large French window, one could watch the sea. It was a spellbinding, expansive view of the very late afternoon blue. One could see the shore as well as the rock where Raoul and Margot had lounged for a while, with a clear sight of the strip of land extending out into the sea like a ballerina's gesture of worship and insouciance. He closed the French windows and walked her to the living room.
I could have sworn there was a piano here, she said.
Here?
He asked.
No, over there.
I don't know. Could have been. Maybe they moved it.
Yes, because where else would they have put the dark Baroque bench with the carved lion head on each armrest?
What armrests? With what lion heads? I should know. I grew up in this house.
I was just imagining it, she said.
He took her to the library. The books hadn't moved in more than a century.
See that love seat over there? He pointed. I used to read there. My Little Universe. Stendhal, Forster, Hardy. And my favorites, Thucydides, Herodotus, and Xenophon.
A love seat all to yourself.
This room was my kingdom. It hasn't changed one bit. Not the love seat, not the vases and ugly marble statuettes, not the memories always cluttering in. Let me take you upstairs.
On the stairway up, however, she suddenly stood still, turned around, and looking out of the bay windows in the library, simply said,
I know I've been here before.
He did not say anything, but stared at the afternoon glow upon the stairs and to himself muttered, I know. Chapter 5. By then, Doriana called them downstairs for tea on the veranda.
This is such a beautiful house, said Margot.
Doriana looked at her and smiled.
It took forever for him to decide to let us live in it, she said, pointing at Raoul. We changed so very little, except for the children's rooms. Even the china hasn't changed, cracked and chipped as everything is in this house. But then we like it that way.
Look at this dish, added Doriana.
Pure Limoges, but defaced, thanks to the dishwasher, which we were told would scrape all the colors away and blandify everything. But did we listen? The way you cook would scrape off the lining of every human stomach.
He never comes, no matter how many times I invite him.
And with good reason, he retorted.
Margot took her cup and held it in both hands, then removed her red sandals and tucked both her feet on the bar under Raoul's wicker chair.
This is heaven, she finally said.
You are welcome to come here any time. Not him, though. Don't trust her. She'll cook dinner for you, and the next thing is you won't tolerate anyone else's cooking, including your own. She is a Circe in the kitchen. After her chicken marengo, you'll never be able to eat anyone else's chicken. To say nothing of her tarte tatin, ruins you for life.
A moment of silence followed, as all three sipped their tea and watched the setting sun cast glowing colors on the horizon.
It's so peaceful here, said Margot. The strange thing is that this is all too familiar, as if I've been on this very patio before.
Well, the house was designed by a French architect who built so many houses on the same model that it wouldn't surprise me if you've been in others as well. You'll find his houses in Poland and Hungary.
No, I've been here, in this house, on this very patio.
Margot swore that there was a piano downstairs and a wooden love seat with sunken cushions and two armrests bearing the carved features of two lion heads. Plus, I'm almost sure I've been in the library, and especially up and down the stairway in the afternoon. And yet, I know this is my very first time here. I've never even been to the south of Italy before. A déjà vu, exclaimed Doriana, chewing on a biscuit. Margot smiled back, but suddenly stiffened. She removed her feet from under Raoul's chair, put down her cup on the forged iron table with pointed metal leaves, looked around her, and turning to Raoul, if I believed in spells, I'd say I was under one. Am I under a spell?
Do people still believe in spells? Asked Doriana. You remind me of my grandmother.
Then what is happening? I can even recognize the patterns on the china now, faded or not, said Marco.
But everyone owns this kind of china the world over. You'll find it in any shop.
Margot picked up her teacup again, but then put it back down on the table. I know where the bathroom is, and I know this house. I even know where an old sewing machine used to be. And turning to Raoul, said, Explain. And seeing he hesitated, Now. This was the moment he had feared the most. Leading up to it had been fun, even sweet. But this now was pure agony.
Let's start with the lighthouse, he said, then move on to the bus depot, then the slaughterhouse, finally the amusement park. We'll even throw in Frutta de Lira.
Yes, and?
You are amazingly right, each and every single time. You were even right about the rock when we sat on it.
What did I say?
You spoke about grapes.
What about the grapes?
Raoul recognized the same signs of vexation on her face he had witnessed a few days earlier, when Margot had resented his knowledge of so many private facts about her and her friends. Would you let me explain?
Yes, go ahead, explain, and now.
Just let me proceed at my own pace, he said, giving her a chilling, momentary glance.
He stood up, went to a bookcase, and took down a large picture book of old black-and-white photographs taken by Luigi Alberti.
Every family in the area owns this book, he said, because it captures the landscape as it was immediately after the war.
He opened the book to the little town they had just visited. Here was the bus depot. There, the amusement park. There, the slaughterhouse. And just in case she had any doubts, on the cover of the book was a faded sepia picture of the long arm of the bay with a tiny square shed at its very tip.
Just as you described it, he said. The lighthouse. But let me give you some background.
And so he began to tell her about a young man whose family summered every year in southern